You are listening to episode 278 of the Game Deflators Podcast. My name is John, and here on the Game Deflators Podcast, we like to talk about games we've recently picked up, games we're currently playing, and this week I'm joined by Brian Rigsby of Retro Game Books. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it, man. Brian, if you could just give a quick little tidbit of who you are, maybe where folks can find you.
Yeah, of course. So my name is Brian Rigsby. I live in San Francisco with my family. I'm a former game developer. I've left that behind a long time ago. And I'm the owner and operator of Retro Game Books. So retrogamebooks.com for people that want to check it out. We produce a number of different types of retro gaming books, including history books, art books, and everything in between, some Metroid theme stuff, map series. We even have a coloring book and lots more on the way that I can tell you about later. You can see us at Portland Retro Gaming Expo later this year. We'll try to pop into some other expos as well. And I'm on all the social media platforms except for TikTok and Facebook, so you can find Retro Game Books there pretty easily. And yeah, that's pretty much my identity these days, is running that. We've been around since 2020, and lots more to come, and I'd love to tell everyone about that later.
Awesome. We've actually had a couple giveaways for Brian on the Twitter handle as well as Facebook. So you can find those at Game Deflators on Twitter or X, at The Game Deflators on Instagram and Facebook and Threads. We're also on thegamedeflators.com, and of course, you can find us on YouTube at The Game Deflators, as well as your podcast app you're listening to now. Leave us a 5-star review, leave some comments, like, subscribe, all that good stuff. All right, so Brian, before we start diving into everything, let's talk about some gaming pickups. I mean, you're a gamer, obviously. You've got Retro Game Books. So I'll pass it off to you first. Is there anything that you picked up this week from any type of gaming, board game, card game, video game?
Sure. So it's kind of funny. I was recently gifted a PSP. I haven't actually received it yet. It's in the hands of the gifter, but it is guaranteed to me. So I started, crawling around in eBay and looking for some PSP games and getting some recommendations from my friends. I'm told I'm getting some games with it. I don't even know what they are. So I'm kind of excited. I'm not expecting them to be, blockbuster type titles, but the one game I did pick up based on a recommendation is called Everyday or Everyday Extra, not to be confused with the digestive probiotic that seems to come up when you search for it as well, if you don't put PSP next to it. But it looks like a fun kind of, I don't know, it looks almost like a space puzzle kind of rhythm game. It looks like a rhythm game, but I don't play a lot of rhythm and dance kind of style games, but this one was recommended, so I'm going to check it out. My very quick PSP story is that I used to own one. It was at my last gaming job that I had left my PSP with the one game I owned, which was Crisis Core, the Final Fantasy VII prequel that I think people are starting to recognize again now that people are playing a lot of FF7. And some people broke into our office late at night when we weren't there, and they didn't take much. They tried to get into our server room. They couldn't. But they did take my PSP with Crisis Core that thankfully I had finished. But I've always been bitter about losing my PSP. And so I'm really excited to get it back. So it's like, this is my latest pickup. I just haven't actually done anything with it yet, but I will soon.
Which version is it, like the PSP 3000? Is it like a special edition one you're getting?
I don't like even know. I felt like it was beggars can't be choosers. And I was so happy that someone reached out to me and said, like, I'm moving, I'm getting rid of so much stuff. And I said, you're crazy to give this to me. But thank you. And I appreciate it. And I will take anything you're willing to give me. I think there's some other things in the goodie bag that's been left for me. I just need to go get it pretty soon and check it out.
Hey, that's the best type of gaming pickup, man. And a game I was going to recommend, you probably already played it or heard it, Luminous, the puzzle game with like the little
blocks.
That
was on my recommendation list, and I do need to check that out for sure.
Yeah, that is a good one. It's a lot of fun. So I've actually got 1 and 2, I think, on my PSP. So, awesome. Yeah. So as far as, I guess, gaming pickups on my end, I went to Game On Expo yesterday. So I'll talk about that here in a bit. But one of my pickups was Cathedral on the Nintendo Switch. So our friends at Premium Edition Games, who will actually be on next week to hype on or hype up their direct that they're going to have on Monday of next week, they have Cathedral. And that's one of the games that they sell. So I picked up a copy there, as well as the hype button patch that they had at their booth. So it was a lot of fun to kind of chat with them and get a couple goodies. And as far as gaming pickups, I think that's it on my end, actually. I've been kind of few and far between. I guess I did finally get my copy of .hack GU remastered, or whatever it is, on PS4. I had noted that on the last podcast episode, and it finally came in. It's got some thumbprint smudges all over it from Amazon as a used copy, but I mean, you can't complain at like $17. So it's totally worth it, that price point. So I guess the next thing here is gaming pickups. I mean, not gaming pickups, sorry. Games we're currently playing. We already did gaming pickups. Is there anything that, you know, you're kind of dabbling into right now? Maybe something you're heavily involved with for gaming?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm the kind of person where I like to just play one game at a time. I'm kind of similar with like TV shows and stuff too. Just kind of pick my lane, get into the narrative, like soak it all in. So the only game I'm playing right now is Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, which I'm sure many people are playing. People listening right now, do not worry. I'm not here to spoil anything. I'm extremely anti-spoiler, so I would not do that. I'll just say that I absolutely love it. I'm itching to jump into it again as soon as I have some time. It's just such a pleasure of a game. It's absolutely incredible. The game I had finished before this was Octopath Traveler 2, which is also excellent and also has that advantage of something you can play on the Switch. So that was great on the go. But yeah, Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, I can't believe what they've been able to do with this series. And it's taken, you know, remakes to a whole different level. And every minute I play, I'm enjoying it more than the minute before. It's something you think you would get a little tired of, but nope. It's not something I'm getting tired of, you know, dozens of hours in.
So I do have to ask you on this one, because I haven't played it yet and I haven't really scoured the internet to find as much as I can, because I'm obviously waiting until the next one before I even start up the remake, which I'm sure is a disservice to myself to do that. But still, when we say spoilers for this game, is there a lot of like obvious differences, maybe from like a story perspective or just an in-game perspective, that would constitute as major spoilers beyond what we know of Final Fantasy VII? I'm just genuinely curious on that.
Yeah, it's a good question. And for what it's worth, I have a friend who's doing what it sounds like you're doing, which is waiting for the trilogy to kind of wrap up to just kind of binge it all, which I think is bold, because my guess is like the biggest spoilers are going to come in the third part. I'm not done with the second one, so I don't really know. I can say that I've been saved from seeing any big spoilers online, so that either means they're not there or I'm being really careful. I don't know, right? I'm too scared to look closer, but my experience so far is similar to the first entry in the remake. It really just adds a lot of content. It really kind of beefs things up. It changes some things too, but not in like a major way. But then it adds new layers on top of the story, both old and new, which again, I don't want to spoil, but it's just different. It also has these meta layers. It almost feels like an ode to like the developers, like they're part of the meta layer as well. It just has so many layers just kind of baked in. It's something that you could enjoy if you've never played the original. I've heard of people that played a remake and then played the original and now are playing Rebirth, and they have a whole different perspective about it because of the order in which they're doing it, which I think is really fascinating. I had replayed the original something like 7 years ago, so it's like kind of just enough to kind of remember, and I'm like, oh yeah, I remember this chocobo thing kind of. But it's definitely different. It is packed, absolutely packed with content.
Nice. Yeah, and I think there's side quests and things of that nature too that probably weren't in the original games for PS1. So it's been a while for me too. I think I last played it in 2009-ish, maybe 2010, mm-hmm. was when I played the original, or replayed the original, I should say. So it's been a while for me too. You're a lot closer to it, obviously. It's 7 years than I am, but I'm excited. I mean, it's a game that I've had my eye on for some time. We've known of like a remake coming since like the PlayStation 2 days. They've been talking about this. So the fact that we're finally seeing it kind of come to fruition all these years later is fantastic.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. All right. So for me on my currently playing, I have continued similar to you, Brian. I don't have like multiple games I'm playing right now. I've brought it up in the past that like my wife and I have a game we play. I've got my game. She has her game. So together we're playing three different games, you know, between us. So for me, my game right now is Tales of Symphonia. I have, of course, continued to have the issue of falling asleep because, well, I'm just tired at night. And that's when I do my main bit of gaming. The other issue is I was out of town this entire week. So like my gaming just did not, you know, really progress the way I would like to, because I was on the East Coast for like Monday through Thursday. So that said, I did play a little bit of Tales of Symphonia this week. I got through to the Tower of Mana in the game, and I am starting on the puzzles in that particular area. The idea there is to find essentially a cure for some of the creatures that have been created by the designs in the game. And so I'm just kind of progressing through that naturally and just enjoying the gameplay. I mean, I'm really starting to get a hang for the battle system there. I am being forced in a way to choose to play with different characters, because now we're in this like split the party mode for the game, where, oh, we're three gonna, you know, go do this, and you three are gonna do this instead, you know, within this level. And so you're kind of forced to use characters you normally wouldn't have used. And so it can get a little confusing when I'm like, oh, let me try and attack while I'm half asleep. And no, I'm not actually using the main character as a sword. I'm using this character as a staff, and only does 10 damage instead of 80 damage. So it's been quite interesting the last few times I've played it, but it's progressing nicely. I'm liking the story. I'm glad I'm playing it finally. It's a game that I've noted before was always on my list of games to play. Decided one day, let me just boot this thing up and go with it. And then after I'm finished with this game, I will be playing Alundra on the PS1, which is my new game's resolution game. I've heard so many great things about that title, and I'm excited to dive into that world and just go into another PS1 RPG.
No, that's awesome. So, I have not played this game, but that's, I mean, aside from the sleepy side of things, it sounds great.
Yeah, for sure. Dude, I'm sure you can relate to that one in some ways, oh, trying to play some games. And yeah, dude, especially the toddler side is like crazy.
a toddler is a full-time job in and of itself. So
yeah,
so that's a different work. Podcast.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. Dads Who Game. That's the next podcast. All right. So before we go into our topic that we had today, which was going to be a little bit of talking on recent gaming movies or shows that we've watched, maybe something we're excited for, I'm going to give a quick overview of Game On Expo and my experience there. Have you been to Game On Expo, Brian?
I have not been there in the flesh. No.
Okay. Well, I'm sure you know about it.
I definitely know about it. Yeah.
Yeah, it is a big one. So Game On Expo is taking place March 15th to 17th at the Phoenix Convention Center, obviously in Phoenix, this year. So today is the 17th. It's the last day, but keep an eye out for next year. I think the biggest thing that I noticed difference wise this year was the weather. The Game On Expo has always been hosted in August. It has transitioned to March, which is the best thing that they could have done. I think it's going to help them boost attendance. It's going to get more people there from out of state. And in general, it just feels much better, I'm sure, for cosplayers that are at the event to not have 95, 110 degree weather that they're going through. So that's a huge pro right there. They did do some changes this year. So the event was no longer hosted in one section of the convention center. They actually moved it to a larger section, which on like the first floor, like ground level to the road, it is actually even with like the food court and all that good stuff and some other rooms, those of which weren't being used. It was on the lower level of that particular part of the convention center where they had an expanded vendor space, which is fantastic. A larger space for guests, which was absolutely loaded compared to prior years. And just really a lot of room to grow. So for me, looking at it, there was obvious growth in the event. You know, it's definitely a larger event, but it still has that charm of a smaller event. And I can say that because I used to run my own for a number of years. And so seeing the the way they process everything, your t-shirts, your tickets, their media passes, everything is still so very hands-on. And it's not like you're going to the airport and you're scanning something, or you're dealing with like somebody who just like doesn't know about the event or isn't interested. There's just still a lot of that charm for that smaller type of setting. The guest selection was fantastic. They had a lot of variety. So they had like Sean Schimmel there. Eric Stewart was there from Pokemon. You had Dan Green from Yu-Gi-Oh! Tons of people from the Baldur's Gate games. They had the folks from Mortal Kombat, the original movies, some older folks. There's I forget his name, but he used to do, he's the EA sports guy, or not EA sports guy. Sorry. He's the guy that did NBA, NBA Jam. He was there. So we had
Tim Kritz.
Yes.
Yep. Kritzrow. I'm butchering his last name, but he was at Portland last year. I saw him there too.
Yeah. So he was there, Paul Niemeyer, which I would normally butcher Paul's name, but I've talked to Paul on a number of occasions at this point. So Paul Niemeyer, the artist from Mortal Kombat, was there again. He's actually made an appearance, I think, every year. And Darren Hupke of 32-Bit Library was there as well. We also had our friends at the Sega Saturn Shiro podcast were there. So we chatted with them. So a lot of good people that we've met over the years, and a lot of new connections as well. So that was fun. Glad to see more tabletop gaming. So last year, it seemed like they had taken a step back for tabletop gaming. I didn't see as much. I didn't see a lot of D&D vendors last year in comparison. Not as many like tabletop card games. This year, there definitely seemed to be more of that, which was fantastic to see. So really excited about that. Gaming definitely remains at the core of this event. So definitely felt like in terms of vendors, there were less, you know, collectors who happen to have some stuff sitting in their garage and they couldn't sell it on eBay, so they decided to slap it on a table in the vendor space. Like, there was less of that this year, which was great. My thought is that they either raised vending prices, so it kind of reduced the amount of people like that that were coming through, or those people, just given where gaming prices are today and how difficult it is just like go garage sailing and get stuff, probably less of those types of folks remaining that are just jumping in these events to sell their excess off. So it was nice. And then there was just a decent selection of vendors in general. Lots of good artists, authors, gaming folks, just, you know, different vendors. It was great. There was a lot of that going for it. I mentioned a new location already, so I was definitely happy about that. And then I didn't get to see much programming, but this year they definitely had a wrestling ring in the middle of the vendor room, which was, I don't know, dude, if you've gone to any of these expos and there's a wrestling ring there, this is a first for me. And I was like, what the heck? It was, I think, IZW Wrestling is who it was. So I think they're local to Phoenix. I didn't get to see a wrestling match. I kind of wish I would have, but I had my toddler with me. So that that was going to be an issue.
Just having him sit there. And
yeah, it was, dude, it was interesting. Like,
I mean, I've seen giant screens, giant controllers. I feel like those are usually the oversized novelties, but I've definitely have never seen a professional wrestling ring. And I think that's kind of awesome.
Yeah, I actually had a good laugh out of that one. So they had straight up wrestling matches, people with titles. I didn't get to see any, but I kind of wish I would have. That would have been interesting. They did have Ted DiBiase there, though. The million dollar man. Yeah, he was actually there. I didn't get to see him. I kind of wish I would have like snapped a photo from a distance, but didn't get to see him. And then as far as like general program panels and all that, I didn't get to go to any programs this year. I'm not going to go in there with a toddler. I'm just not, you know, to disrupt any of that. But I have been at a program in the past. It's always good. You know, most conventions are pretty good with their programming. And then there's some that are notoriously bad, where panels don't get hosted and all of that. These always pop off. There's always a great fan base within the panels, good discussion points that are made. So, you know, I didn't feel I needed to dive into a panel to kind of re-review what I've seen in the past and has been very positive at this event. And then the only issue I had, and this is, I think, just generally a market issue nowadays, and you've probably seen this too, Brian, is when you go to these events now, once they get to a certain like size, the guests that they bring in from like voice actors and actors and all of that, it gets to a point where there's so many of them. And if you want to meet them, you better be ready to pay up. They all are on a guarantee basis. So they're all sitting there, they're charging however much. I saw autographs yesterday for like $60, selfies for $50, things of that nature. So, I mean, if you don't have a ton of money and you're going in this thinking, I'm going to, you know, buy a ticket, I'm going to enjoy some free programming, I'm going to get a picture of one of my favorite voice actors or actors or artists, whoever it may be, in addition to buying stuff, be ready to shell out some money for sure.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like you mentioned the voice actor from NBA Jam. I mean, the one thing I could add to that conversation is that I read that NBA Jam book last year. And one thing that was pretty eye-opening about it was just how little money he made, because this was before people were thinking about royalty deals, you know, quite as much, mm-hmm. right? To get that kind of like reoccurring revenue into the future. And it was more of like, hey, we need you for a couple hours, record your lines, here's your money, you know, come back again, maybe for the next game, we'll reuse some stuff. And that guy deserves a much bigger slice of the pie. And unfortunately it's not coming, you know, from the publisher and developer. So I definitely don't, in cases like that, I don't blame, you know, kind of crowdsourcing that a little bit into the future. But at the same time, you think about the, you know, your average person in there, like they can't shell out $60 for every single autograph on the floor, right? They're probably thinking, oh, I'm looking for that one rare game or that one missing piece in my collection. I got to kind of pick and choose, you know, where I put this money. And so it's a hard choice, I'm sure.
Yeah. And, you know, in the instance of some of those older artists and voice actors, you know, that were in the game very early on, like you said, before royalties were a thing, totally get that, right? Like Tim's prices were actually well below what other folks are charging. Whereas there were some folks that I'm not going to call out names, but some folks that I was seeing there, but you know that they are on a lot of recent projects. They've got, you know, SAG behind them. You know, they've negotiated royalties over the years. They're in like prominent games now and like prominent series. And you know, they've made that money and they're sitting there charging like $100 for like a selfie and an autograph type of thing. And like, I get it. You know, you don't want to see your item slapped on eBay and somebody taking advantage saying, hey, can you sign my 20 things? Like, I get that that's the main reason they do that. But then you have your general fans, and it sucks for them, right? Your general fans saying, I want my pop figure signed. And it's like, well, here's $50 to have my signature on there. And in the grand scheme of things, like, I don't mean in like a super negative way, but a lot of the folks that are signing stuff, their stuff isn't going for like $300-$400 on eBay, right? We're not talking about like Hall of Fame quarterbacks and things of that nature. We're talking, you know, somebody that voiced a character in a video game or voiced a character in animation or, you know, a particular show may have had a few lines. And that's kind of disheartening to me to see that nowadays. And that's really just where the industry has gone in general and where scalping has kind of taken things too. So it sucks, but I guess as a consumer, just be aware that if you're going in, you know, kind of create a plan, think about what you want to spend your money on, think about who you want to see, who you want to selfie with, do your research beforehand. So you come in fully prepared to say, I'm going to spend X amount of dollars at this event, and you don't find yourself like deep in a hole.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a tough one. Yeah. The reseller market really, really taints the water.
Yeah, man. So I've actually got, an autograph that I picked up a long time ago from Roger Staubach, who's a Hall of Fame quarterback, Dallas Cowboys and such. And, I had met him cause I was working at events, that I was hosting. And so he actually like, he's so hesitant to sign a ton of autographs because what ends up happening is people are just flipping them on eBay, right? So like, mm-hmm. Hey, Roger, here's a $20 football I just bought at Walmart. Can you sign your autograph on here? Okay, cool. And then they throw it on eBay for $300. You know, like, so I can kind of see where a lot of those folks are like, I'd rather charge, because then that kind of gets away from the fact of like, it devalues your autograph in a sense too, right? If you're giving away for free. So I get it. So overall with this event, there's tons of options. I mean, you're looking at Friday, Saturday, Sunday to be able to attend this event. You know, it's a 3-day period, so it's great. There's going to be content for the entire family. Kids 2 and under were free. So it was kind of nice. I had my media pass, was able to go in, cover the event. And at the same time, had my toddler running around eating his snacks and he was content. So definitely check it out when it happens next year. It's definitely a worthwhile event and there's a little bit of something for everybody. All right. Some video game movies and TV shows before we dive a little deeper into retro game books. So during my trip, I was actually able to see the Gran Turismo movie and I thought it was fantastic. I was actually pleasantly surprised by the overall movie. You know, what they did with that film, I don't know if you've seen it yet, but they took the GT program that they did years ago, which was to take folks that were playing Gran Turismo and turn them into real life drivers. And it's a legit story. They did this with like 12 different people, I think. Several of them have gone on to become like actual good racers who have, you know, won races, some of the best in the world. And so I just thought it was a real, like, I didn't know about that first off. So that was a pretty cool thing to hear. And like, as I'm going through the movie, I'm just listening to talk about like this GT program, like, wow, that's, you know, how's this based on a true story? And then they kind of end it with, oh yeah, like here's a racer it's based off of, and here's a program. And it was a legit thing. I'm like, holy crap. Like, that's pretty cool. So, you know, if you haven't seen it, you're probably wondering like, how the heck did I take Gran Turismo and turn it into a movie? Right. And like, that was my initial reaction when I first saw the trailer. I'm like, this is going to be stupid, but I mean, it was great. They took this whole thing, this idea of like, you know, looking at from a gamer's perspective, like the life of a gamer, some of the scrutiny they might get from family who say you're never going to accomplish your dreams, all that good stuff, and turn into like this heartwarming story of this kid that enters this program, goes into training for becoming a racer, and like takes what he enjoyed so much about gaming and turns it into like his passion, right? Like, or another passion, right? Something that he's wanted to do his whole life. And I just thought it was a really cool story. It definitely felt like those heartwarming sports movies where it's, you know, the underdog kind of doing their thing and progressing into, you know, the person that they are at the end of the film. And I liked it. I mean, I just, there's just so much about that film in general that just kind of, you know, sets it apart from other gaming movies. And I think the core thing is that it really is based off like that true story and not just a straight adaptation, which we're traditionally seeing in a market. So
yeah, haven't seen it. No. And I didn't know about the premise that you just described, which definitely makes it more intriguing and interesting. I totally expected, to your point, a very generic racing movie, maybe with a random, you know, love story or just something generic. I just thought they were just using, you know, the names coming back. It's got good recognition still. I didn't think there would be more to it than that. So that's interesting. I'll check it out.
Yeah, I will tell you, if I had to choose between the Uncharted movie and the Gran Turismo movie, I'm watching that Gran Turismo movie like 10 times over.
Yeah, I mean, the Uncharted movie is not great.
No.
That's all I'll say.
So is there anything that you've caught recently from a... Just from gaming movies or adaptations?
Yeah, I mean, the movies I've seen lately, I mean, these ones aren't gaming, but I mean, I saw Dune Part 2. It's great. I saw The Marvels. It was not great. I rewatched Spirited Away. It's still great. The gaming movie that I've seen the most lately has been really driven by my son. When, you know, we watch in 30-minute bursts at the end of the day, which is the Mario movie. So I think I've found every Easter egg in this movie at this point because I don't really have a choice but the let my eyes gloss over, glaze over, and like just kind of stare at things in the background and close my eyes and listen for like weird little sound motifs to kind of fire off. And I'm like, oh, right, that's that sound effect from that old game, or that's that thing in the background that says level 1-2 when they go into the basement. Like those cute little things that they kind of added in there because I can't enjoy the storyline anymore after the first going. The other thing I'm checking out on the TV side is it's video game adjacent, I guess you could say, which is the original X-Men cartoon from the mid-90s, because like a lot of people, I'm trying to like kind of catch up on it so I can watch X-Men 97 when that drops soon. And it's one of those shows where I had seen a little bit of it as a kid, but I had also read a lot of the comics and it felt a little repetitive, and I was kind of, I don't know what else I was watching, but I was watching something else at the time. So I didn't really give it the time of day. Everyone knew it had a banger of a soundtrack. Everyone knew Cyclops was extremely moody as he always is and all these kind of things, but I hadn't really gotten into it. But it's actually a really cool show. Has some janky animations at times, but a lot of 90s cartoons did. But it has lots of endearing qualities as well. And I just think it's cool to be part of this collective hype of being ready for this new show that's going to carry the torch forward, seemingly, you know, as if they never missed a day and they're moving into 1997. And hopefully that has that great nostalgic feeling for me, like, oh, are they going to act as if the last storyline is just where they're picking up? Or are they going to kind of reboot things and pretend it's fully new? I don't know. But I'm going in optimistic and kind of looking forward to it. And hopefully it spins off another video game somehow out of it.
Yeah, for sure. You know, what's interesting is with like that 90s X-Men and like 90s Batman and a lot of those, I think I was at the age at that point where I just couldn't get into them back then. I don't know what it was. I think it's because my maturity level wasn't there yet when they were out. That it just didn't stick to me that the way it does for a lot of other people. Like Gargoyles is another one. Like that was a show that I watched a little bit as a kid, but I just could never truly get into it versus like Power Rangers, right? Like, which I think at that point probably required a little less attention to detail and what was happening. So what I need to start doing is actually rewatching a lot of those shows and start appreciating like what it was back then that I kind of missed out on. Cause for me, it just never stuck. It wasn't like my true nostalgia piece. Right. But yeah, I mean, but I'm really exactly happy to see those. Yeah. There, it was a lot of high level details. It's what it came down to. I'm sure there's a lot of innuendos in there too, but I never caught when I was younger for obvious reasons. So, you know, with a lot of these gaming adaptations too, 2023 in general, I had quite a few, but I didn't even know. Like there was a new Castlevania, series that had been released. Ominousha apparently, had a series released on Netflix. I had no idea. You know, and then of course, like 2024, we're looking at things like there's a Tomb Raider show, like an animated Tomb Raider that's coming out. We're of course going to get, you know, 2025, The Last of Us Part Two. I think 2026 is the new Mario movie, if I recall correctly, from the direct or 5 minute direct they had on Mario Day. So the future is bright as far as gaming adaptations is concerned into TV and movie. So I'm excited. There's a lot of good stuff.
That Castlevania show, the few seasons that they have, I personally think are excellent. I just think they've done such a good job building on those classic NES characters, and the animation is beautiful. The story's good. It's very witty dialogue. It's fun. It's definitely worth checking out, even if you only lightly like Castlevania. As long as you like the dark kind of theme, I think people will be into it.
So like the first three or four seasons they released, I loved it. I actually watched those. The one that was just released, I think it was, God, what's the name? I just saw it. It starts with like an N. I think for whatever reason, I think
it's like Nocturne.
Nocturne. Yeah. You know what? I hear Nocturne and I automatically think, what's Shin Megami Tensei? Nocturne. So every time I hear about it, that's what I think of. But yeah, so that Castlevania series that was released, this past year, that particular season, I haven't seen that one yet. So I'm definitely interested to see, like, is it as good? Like, will it hold up as well as the other animated series that they released, the four seasons or five seasons? Because that was, to your point, man, like the battle at the end and the artwork that's tied to that was like, it was just on another level. So I guess let's dive into some retro game books. I'm definitely excited to hear everything you have to say about what's going on. So, you know, I want to start off, you know, a little light here. What is your favorite gaming console?
Yeah. So the one I always come back to is the NES. So the 8-bit era, it's like we were talking about with cartoons, right? It's all about the age in which you first experience something. Although I will say, you know, even for a younger generation, if you were to jump into the NES today, I think you will definitely find something interesting about it, as long as you know, stick to maybe the more popular games. But for me, it's just that thing where every, whatever, 5 years or so, I go back to it. I play some of my favorite games again. I try to discover a few I had never touched before. I have my original NES still that's had the pin connector replaced multiple times, but I also have a more modern version that I can run old hardware on, in case I want to, you know, run HDMI into my smart, in quotes, TV. And I just think it's like, it's so beautiful to see, you know, how they designed games back then, during this third generation, and how much it's influenced games today. The way they tell stories with very little dialogue, the way the manuals tie into the gameplay, which is true for other systems. That's not just like an NES thing, but just the importance of them. I also like, there's some homebrew games that come out every now and then, and some of them are worth checking out, you know, like people put a lot of work into these things, and it does pay off at times. And Full Quiet was one I played last year, brand new NES game. It's so amazing. I drew a map on grid paper and had so much fun doing it, pretending I was a kid again, solving puzzles. It's an excellent game. If you like the NES, please support them and check it out. But yeah, it's gotta be the NES. Two buttons was all you needed, and they did it well.
So you and I are from similar time period in terms of gaming. For me, it was a Super Nintendo. actually. So just a little after you on that, as far as like what I grew up with. And same deal as you, man. Like I've got the retro, like original retro setup if I want to play VAT, but I've also got the Retron 5 chill in there to do via HDMI to the smart TV, as you said. So, so how did you, like, I think I know the answer here, right? Like we probably all do, but how did you get into creating retro game books?
Yeah, so my wife would probably call it a midlife crisis. I like to think of it more as grit, determination, motivation, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, really what it is my son was on the way. I was looking for like the next challenge. Like in the past, you know, like when I was a game developer, for example, I was always doing things kind of in my spare time, like something to like further challenge me creatively. Like I would make maps for Counter-Strike Source, and I made a 5-level campaign for Left 4 Dead 2, all kinds of other things that I kind of challenged myself with over the years. Like I did jujitsu for 8 years and was spending 10 hours a week doing that and just getting obsessed with it. And then I injured out of that. And I said, okay, like this is my time to do something new. The kids come in. I fully expected in early 2020 when I kicked this off to just write one book, put everything into it, put it out there, see how people responded, positive or negative. I thought I was just going to do a one-off and walk away, but it became an obsession for me, which quickly became a business. And so the first book was The Complete History of Rygar, which is something I selected because it's in like my top 5 or 10 NES games. Like people think I'm some like Rygar expert obsessed person. I think I became something like that in going through the process. But that required the research necessary to do it. I uncovered so many things I didn't know about this series. I grew up on the arcade game and then the NES game. I played the PS2 game, but I didn't play the other ports until doing the research. I didn't know about all the obscure, Japanese comics and guides and even like physical games they made for it. I learned about all these artists, and that's where I saw a lot of fun in collaborating with artists and like having an art gallery. And there's a musician who submitted sheet music for Rygar games that he wrote up himself. Bands that have covered songs, including Rygar. All these things are just mashed in there. And what I thought was going to be a 50-page book, the scope creeped in and it became much, much bigger than that. And I did an extended edition after the initial launch as well. Which became a bundle with posters and, you know, cards and stickers and everything. And so people responded really positively to it. And I thought, you know, I'm going to just keep this going. I'm going to keep working with different artists. I want to bridge this into different types of books, bring in other writers as well, which I can get into later. And so that's kind of how it kicked off. It started as a kind of a humble beginning and the response was good. So I kept it going.
Yeah, that Rygar book, I think when we first started talking to you a few years back, I think it was right after release of that. And, you know, we got our hands on it and dove into it. And it's phenomenal. And especially all the little goodies that you had in there with the cards and posters and that stuff. That was a lot of fun. And whoever ended up winning that, hope you enjoyed it. So if you're listening today. So it was a pretty cool one that we got to dive into. We definitely enjoyed it. And actually kicked off, like as we were going through your book, we hadn't played Rygar yet on the podcast. We're like, all right, let's dive into Rygar, you know, like let's see what it's about. And we actually enjoyed that one. That was a good game for sure. So that dives into my next question here, which is, you know, where do you like draw inspiration to create some of these specific books? Like, is there anything outside of like what you've just described to really just kind of put yourself into that topic wholeheartedly?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a number of things, right? Like, so with retro gaming, obviously I'm a huge fan. Retro gaming is like, it's a rolling timeline, right? Like there will always be retro games. It's not like it's some moment in time. It's not third and fourth generation only. I know everyone has their own definition. I try to go with like 20 years old, roughly, is kind of my cutoff. Everyone's definition is fine. It's subjective. But there's always going to be untapped territory to jump into. And on that point about, you know, the untapped territory, like I want to create things that haven't been done before. Like, I think there's amazing gaming coffee table books out there, for example, and art books, but I want to make sure I'm doing something somewhat unique. I want to tap into a niche. I want to do something that hasn't quite been done before. And, you know, the Rygar book is definitely a strong example of that. with the video game map series, I think a lot of people out there, retro and modern gaming enthusiasts alike, love maps and games, in-game manuals, posters, you know, whatever it is. But I wanted to see something that really pulled it all together. And so that's why I've been continuing that kind of series. The kind of test I give when I decide, should I pull this out of my backlog and start producing something or hire, you know, contract someone to work with me on this, is this something I want on my own shelf? Is this something I would put in my own collection? If the answer is no, I'm not going to do it. So that's kind of like the first line of defense. Like, is this worthwhile to me? And so I'm not just proud of the stuff I've produced or worked with people on just because it's been created, but I look at it, I flip through it. I'm like, okay, it's been a little while. It feels fresh. Sure. When you create things, they, you get a little burned out on them, because it takes a lot more hours, I think, than people might realize, or maybe they do. But when I can go back to it and have that fresh feeling again, it feels great. The other thing is that there's like a lot of content and like, especially in like Japanese, you know, magazines and guides and stuff that a lot of the, you know, the Western and North American population, like maybe hasn't had a chance to really explore. These things are more accessible these days if you really, really dig, but I like to kind of see like those different areas kind of mashed together and seen in a cohesive way. The other thing I think about a lot about is like preservation, right? Like there's some people out there that are really into like preservation, like archive.org and like the video game library and like other projects like that. And I want to be a part of that in some way. I want to make it so that if these games are hard to find in the future, many of them are already hard to find, and there's little facts people want to know, and they don't want to spend hundreds of hours looking up a certain topic. They want to see it in a book. We have that preserved, like it's there. And then the last thing I'll say is I'm always looking to collaborate. I just think it's fun. So the Metroid book, it's called Pixel Art Metroid. It's got interviews, it's got tutorials, it's got articles, but the meat of it is an art gallery of modern pixel artists. And so, you know, everyone permitted to have their work featured in that. And it's something like 150 plus people. And it's just, like, how else are you going to see all these things come together unless one person puts in the time to kind of pull it all together? And so I'm willing to do that. And I want to see all these things together and collaborate with these people. The other part of collaboration that's really fun is we always contract different artists for the covers. You know, we've dipped back into some people, but like I'm trying to work with a breadth of people for variety's sake and diversity's sake. And I just love seeing brand new art that is inspired by retro gaming in some way. Be created and commissioned for something new and original. And so I just loved having those kind of collaboration moments. And we're just starting to collaborate with new authors as well. So that's going to be a new territory too.
Nice. You know, you brought up a good point on the bringing it all together, right? Like having to search it up. And, you know, it's a good point, right? Like you could sit there and Google every single thing and try to piecemeal it together and make sort of semblance of like the history of some of these games and, you know, the content that you've done, or you could pick up a book like you've got, right? And it's all kind of compiled together. And if you want to do any additional research beyond that and, you know, explore deeper, you're welcome to it. But just having all of that in one source, I think is fantastic. And the fact that it doesn't involve the internet, it doesn't involve having to search up a bunch of content because it's right there at your fingertips. So it's pretty cool.
And the one thing I'd add to that is like, we're, you know, while I offer digital versions of all the retro game book exclusive content, like we want to be physical first, right? I'm a nostalgic person. I want to hold a book in my hand. We ship internationally, but I know it's cost prohibitive for some people. So I understand that, you know, some people might want to just pick up a digital version. It's cheaper, it's more accessible, it's there, but I just think there's something special about holding a book in your hand and being able to flip through it and just kind of having that joy.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So my next question here for you is, what has been your favorite project to date? And that's got to be a tough one, I'm sure.
Yeah, they're all special for different reasons. Metroid stretched me in terms of having a vast amount of collaborators, as I mentioned. The map series requires a ton of upfront organization. So I wouldn't say that's favorite. It's a kind of grueling work, to be honest, to categorize and validate also, because you have to make sure everything's factual and is true to form. I still think the Rygar book is my favorite ultimately, just because it pushed my limits in terms of the breadth of the research I had to do, the depth I had to go. I had to reach out to people in Japan and use like translators that are, you know, they're decent these days, right? But they're not great. I would literally be like looking at magazines with my video translator app, you know, my Google Translator app, trying to like make sense of the text. And then I talk to my friend in America who's bilingual. He's a former Capcom employee that works at Bethesda now, but he's kind of been my go-to resource of sorts to kind of help me make sense of some of the text. And, you know, I'm very thankful to have people like this in my network. It also really challenged me as a writer, because I don't think of myself as a writer first. I think of myself more as like a designer and a producer, which were the things I did in gaming. But I think of them as also like a producer in the sense of like project management and like kind of putting projects together and making sure they work well and running the business side of things. And on the creative side, like doing layouts and like seeing what works well. But as a writer, like that's something I've had to really fine tune more and more. It's like everyone says, like the more you write, the better you get, and you got to just put things out there. But the point I'm trying to get to is I work with an editor, Justin Severson, and he's an incredible writer. He definitely elevated my words in that book and taught me a lot as I went. He's been editing the majority of the Retro Game Book exclusive books as well. And so I think that's what made that book really pop and come together.
That makes sense. So, I mean, great segue here into my next question, which is, can you give us a little insight into your publishing process? Like, you know, you've mentioned the whole process of bringing it together, obviously an editor, the international shipping, which can be, you know, kind of an issue for some folks and cost prohibitive, but, you know, beyond that, like just making it all come together. Can you give some insights on that with that
yeah, publishing part? So as far as like pre-production and production go, so like I think of it like this, there's pre-production where you're doing all the research, you're trying to decide what you want to do, right? You're in discovery, then you pick something, you pick a lane, then you start to kind of, you know, outline it, do the research, figure out if there's enough meat on the bone to kind of pursue this, start organizing, figure out who your collaborators are going to be. You got to think about like, and I'm getting into the project management terms now, like your lead time, right? Like if I'm going to work with an artist and they need 2 months, but I think, and this book's going to be done in, you know, 4 months. Okay, I better start talking to them soon because it's probably going to take them more than 2 months anyway. How many things can I do in parallel to optimize this without overloading myself? Who's going to be working with me? When? What's their level of commitment? You know, are they being contracted or not? Those types of things. And then when I go into production, you know, if I'm doing layouts or if I'm working with someone else, it kind of depends on what that process will be. I kind of have to balance the business. So it's like, okay, we're working on a book. I'm also working with another person on something else. I'm also doing the kind of table stakes works as well to keep the lights on stuff, right? Like promoting, advertising, you know, updating the website, you know, those kind of things as well. And then when you get into like post-production, you know, promotion kicks in again for the new stuff, you know, printing. I have to decide at that point, or a little before actually, am I going to do pre-orders or am I going to do a surprise release? I actually love doing surprise releases because I just think it's fun to not tease people and just be like, look, this is here. It is available right now. So most of my stuff has been like that. But in order to stay lean, sometimes it's easier to do pre-production. That's often why you see a lot of people doing Kickstarters, which I don't do because I do self-funding for this. But you know, Kickstarters are great for self-funding, but also knowing exactly how many copies you need of something. But I'm more of the mindset of like, I'm going to get a lot of them out there. Let's get it into the hands of people. We can restock it. I've had to restock everything. It's not a big deal. Everything's been direct to consumer off the website. There's no Amazon, there's no Kickstarter. That's just kind of a personal principle thing of mine, but I'm not opposed to maybe doing a Kickstarter in the future. And then as far as like getting involved with retro game books, it's another aspect of publishing process, I would say, which is I'm working with a games journalist right now. She's going to be writing a book. It hasn't been announced yet. The title is a code name right now. So it's like, I won't even mention it, but we have a contract together. So her and I, we talked about ideas we landed on, you know, what are the chapters? What are the themes? Why is this, why does this fit into like Retro Game Book's mission? What would the format look like, et cetera? And we're running with it. And so you'll see new artwork for a cover. You'll see amazing prose, and that'll all be happening. If people want to submit a pitch, by the way, we do have a pitch page on our website. So you can, anyone is welcome to submit a pitch. There's no pitch season. It's kind of just a rolling thing. I cannot reply to everyone. It's just impossible, but I'm always looking for new ideas. Again, something that has not been tapped into before is what's important. And then seeing like people's like writing samples to see like, you know, what is, what do their words look like? What is your style? Like, are you comical? Are you more of a documentarian? They're all great things, but we kind of need to get an idea. Similarly with artists, like I mentioned earlier, I love working with different artists. So please, like, if you're like, oh, I know this artist, or I am that artist that takes commissions, and I love gaming themed stuff, like, you know, shoot us an email. I'm always looking to expand the pool of artists. And then collaboration. I mean, people get messages from me sometimes. I'll be like, hey, I love this thing. Like, I would love it if you could write a pixel art tutorial. What do you think? Like, can we work together? Let's strike a deal. That's what we did in the Metroid book. And I'm always looking for that because I want to have more perspectives, more breadth to the books as well.
Nice. Speak my language around all the marketing stuff. So I love it. We can talk about that off off podcast.
Of course.
Yeah, of course. So last question for you here is, what do you have coming up that people can get excited about? You mentioned the code project here of the other author, but like, what do you have personally going on in retro game books that people can get excited for, see in the coming future, that, you know, that you want to share?
Yeah. So that to be announced book from the to be named games journalist, it's not even a big secret. I'm just kind of like, I feel like when you do PR too early, it kind of falls flat. You got to keep a rhythm. So I just wanted to
hype it up. Yeah, that's exactly what we're doing here. We're teasing the book. People are getting hyped for it. They have no idea what they're going to be getting, but it's something big, right?
It's going to be awesome. I'm excited to name the person. They'll probably name themselves soon as well. They have the green light to do so, for what it's worth. We'll do that soon. But yeah, the one I'm working on is a continuation of the Video Game Maps series. So the next one will be SNES and Super Famicom, which I'm sure you'll be excited about, since I know that's your go-to nostalgic system of choice. And this is going to be a big boy. I don't think calling it a book is fair anymore. It's feeling more like a tome at this point. It very well may be broken into approximately 3 volumes, just because it's going to be pretty hefty. We're looking to do hardcover on this one. You know, the nice glossy paper, of course, that you would want in an art book. But it's going to be a big one. I have this problem when I'm personally working on something where I take things too far, but I also know there's people out there where they want as much content as possible. They don't want things excluded. So I'm trying to pack it all in there. There could be some other things as well. I might do some more apparel, type stuff, you know, probably some more notebooks, you know, little goodies and stuff as well.
Nice. Yeah, we are actually pretty excited about the Super Nintendo one, because you had reached out to us on that one for via the maps. So that one immediately, like, obviously struck my interest. And we were like, hey, we're doing this map book. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Like, I'm excited to see all of these different games and what you compile together. So definitely excited there. All right, man. Well, hey, definitely appreciate you coming on and talking about retro game books and really just gaming in general. I had a blast with it. I mean, it's always good to have folks on.
No, this has been great.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely appreciate you coming on. So if you can just remind everybody, you know, again, your name, social, where they can buy these books, how they can get in touch with you. I think we'll cap it off there.
That sounds good. So head over to retrogamebooks.com. That's retrogamebooks.com. Trying to sound like a commercial here. Check out our books, see what's going on. Sign up for our mailing list. I promise you, I will not spam your inbox. We are not that kind of company. We like to keep things kind of simple and just let you know about the newest releases and restocks and promotions all kind of bundled together in a digest on rare occasion. We have books, but like I mentioned, there's all kinds of extra goodies there as well. There's bundles. We're going to have more apparel soon, stickers, cards. We even have like a cool retro scratcher card, Vampire Hunter scratcher card game, reminiscent of some of the old Nintendo stuff that are part of a little bundle. All kinds of good stuff. Check it out. And then on social, so you can find Retro Game Books on Threads, Instagram. We're on YouTube now too. You'll see more there. You can also find me, Brian Rigsby, on Blue Sky and Twitter, if you find my name there. And yeah, just know that we ship domestically and internationally. We don't have a physical location in other countries. A lot of people ask us about that. Maybe one day, we'll see. But for now, yeah, we do ship direct to consumer internationally. We will take care of you.
Awesome. Brian, appreciate you coming on again. Looking forward to chatting more in the future. This has been episode 278 of the Game of Flayers podcast, and thanks for listening.